Welcome to our discussion segment on What to Watch, History in Movies, Part 3. I'm Jill Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Let's get started. John, I'm taken aback by some of your selections. I know I made little comments here and there.
That was fun doing the
It was. That was a little bit of a change.
Yeah.
We would love to hear some feedback on that. It is a change in format, but John and I are always exploring new ways to engage and have this be informative and entertaining.
Yes.
So if I can address the bad ones first and you can come at me,
because
I think ones are a little bit more fun. I understand why you picked The Last Samurai, and I understand the bad history in it. I did want to ask about the good history in it.
Okay.
Because I think that it did depict samurai culture in a way that was fairly accurate.
It did. Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yep.
Were there certain components of it that you, when you saw that based on your knowledge of the modernization in Japan, that were pretty accurate? And as a follow-up, I wanted to get your opinion about if there are the mistakes in a historical film or a film that's depicting history, but also correct historical moments or facts, is that harder to spot and harder to tell?
It is easier, obviously, to spot flaws in a movie where there is nothing right. But most historical movies, they get some stuff right, with the exception of Elizabeth the Golden Age. I hate that movie.
I have not seen
so
that movie.
Much.
I've not seen that, but I
of
now
all the
don't
movies
want
to. There. Well, actually, no. I hate Da Vinci Code more, which we'll come to. But I'm definitely not a fan of Elizabeth the Golden Age. I know more about, as I talked about in the episode, more about the modernization efforts. So the way they depicted the modernization, if Tom Cruise was a Frenchman speaking French or a German speaking German, would be much more accurate. They were fairly good at depicting the accuracy of the modernization. As far as they depicted samurai culture, from what I've read online, it was fairly accurate. It was just the engagements between the two where it's like, no, that's not how they would have fought.
Thinking about The Last Samurai, it's that mix of the samurai culture, which is depicted fairly well, the modernization is depicted fairly well, amongst the riding into battle with armor that doesn't that barely stops a sword, let alone rounds and cannon fire.
Yeah, that was the big reason why. Since it was a military history section, I went with that. After I read it and after we recorded it, part of me was like, maybe we should have done Braveheart, because that is more historically inaccurate than The Last Samurai. But Braveheart gets beat up on another history podcast. I thought I'd pick one that's maybe not as well known.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have worn kilts for another like 3 or 4 centuries. Be like a World War II movie where you're wearing Starfleet uniforms.
Would you watch that movie?
Recent Star Trek? No.
Can you imagine a movie like... It's like somebody got this very wrong. I would watch that, and that would be on our list.
It probably would be. I really liked, I not just really liked, I loved your pick for military history, All Quiet on the Western Front. Like two other films that we've talked about many times, 1917 and They Shall Not Grow Old, it depicts the brutality of war. This was a German film, which that makes it kind of unique, because the Germans usually don't make films about these periods in their history. What do you think was the unique perspective brought by the fact that it was a German film to the story of World War I?
I think the biggest perspective for me that was a change was the fact that it was coming from the losing side. There was hope at the beginning that you see depicted very well. And that was true all over the world, not just in Germany.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone was excited to be part of the Great War, and then people got there. And I like the movie for that reason as well, because it shows the absolute contrast to what leaders are telling soldiers about what this is going to be. The leaders who, by the way, aren't going, which still happens today. So it goes from that contrast to the reality of it, to the trenches. And you have the contrast of being excited to go, then the reality of the trenches. And then combined with that, you have military tactics that are just unheard of now.
Yeah.
I've heard this on actually several podcasts where soldiers are talking and reviewing tactics from past wars. And one of them is this idea of just getting up out of a trench and running into gunfire.
It was all about elan. It was about, you know, attacking. We will overwhelm them with our bravery.
It did not work out so well.
No.
Yeah. It also shows, as the war continues to go badly, the breakdown of the human psyche.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when there's no hope? What do you have left? And you see, spoiler alert, you see what the person has left.
Yeah.
And it's not good. So it's really understanding the contrasts, and as a result of the contrasts, what the person becomes. Mm-hmm. So that's why I picked it. And a lot of my picks aren't exact history.
Right.
They're just depictions of historical events that I found to be valuable. that told a good story that made you think about what time was like back then. And when I think about World War One, All Quiet on the Western Front is something that comes to mind because of its brutality and reality. How could you send platoons and platoons and platoons and units of men over the wall and watch them get gunned down and do it again? It's got to be a study in culture. It's got to be some kind of justification in the person's mind. But
I don't know if it's culture, because, I mean, that happened on all sides in that war. It happened in the American Civil War. Think of Ambrose Burnside, one of the leading generals early in the Civil War. He's just sending one brigade after another into battle at Fredericksburg, no seeming concern until the battle's over and he sees what has been done.
Yeah.
And then his spirit breaks and he realizes, my gosh, what have I done?
I know that there were several strategists that arose after World War One who spoke to the fact that we can't do this again.
Yes.
And during the war, too.
And they were operators. They were men who were in the trenches. Erwin Rommel, Basilito Hart, people like that. And they were the ones who were leading innovators in not having a repeat of trench warfare in World War One. Back to a bad movie.
Amadeus.
Another good movie that I kind of felt bad criticizing.
Mozart, I know that he's depicted not as the good guy, but as not the bad guy. He's not depicted as the hero, is he?
No.
In your opinion?
Really, no.
It didn't hit me that way. So with that in mind, he really got on my nerves in the film. I like Salieri actually a lot better. I know that he was...
Seriously? You're rooting for the actual villain?
Not for the bad things he was doing, but I just felt like I knew how the movie was going to end, but I was kind of like, I hope you beat this guy. He's kind of a jerk.
I didn't think of him as a jerk.
No?
I thought of him as a self-entitled brat, which he kind of was.
Who?
Mozart.
Oh, yeah, okay. Because
you got to remember, this guy, is from the age of four, he has been in, like, the European courts. He's been playing before kings, before the Pope. He's living an immensely, I hate to use a politically correct term, but a very privileged lifestyle. That's going to mess with anyone, any child prodigy who
I guess...
Go ahead. Well, yeah, go ahead.
I guess the scene that solidified it for me is when he's playing Salieri's piece, and he's improving it.
Yeah.
So he was improving it for sure, but he was like mocking him in the process of playing this piece, making modifications like, that sounds better, doesn't it? Like doing his laugh.
That's interesting. I did not interpret the film that way.
Yeah.
Or that scene that way. But, you know,
that was just.
That's actually a sign of a good movie. Maybe it should have been on your list, not mine, when you can have different interpretations of the same scene.
What was the catalyst for you choosing this?
It's what I said at the very end. Salieri, his reputation and the reputation of his music has really suffered. And as a classical music fan, I really enjoy a lot of his pieces, and they're good. It's not Mozart. Mozart is many, many, many times better. But I wanted to, for audience members who might be interested in classical music, say, hey, it's not just kind of Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, the holy trinity of classical music. And of course, Bach was earlier. I understand that. But there are others. And even some people who are not as well known, like Salieri, are worth getting some attention. And then also just, I really enjoy the movie, and I thought it'd be kind of fun to talk about it. I wanted to kind of be able to have this discussion about, you know, what's historically accurate and what's not in the film, because Mozart was probably not, I don't think anyone in the 18th century would have been crawling around inside a palace chasing a girl. Maybe it did happen, but from the writing that has survived, it seems like both of those men's characteristics and character traits were exaggerated for the purpose of film, and I wanted to kind of discuss, you know, they weren't quite the extremes, the two polar opposites that they appeared to be in the film. Okay, those are the two movies that were actually probably pretty good from this list, from the bad list. Now we get to the garbage.
So what I'm hearing is you still need some practice in choosing bad movies.
I do, yeah. I'm not as good at picking bad movies as you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm really good at it.
You are. You picked some doozies last time.
So here's why.
So next time.
Yeah. Within a bad film, there are good scenes. I can acknowledge that a film is terrible, but there still be a cool scene in it or two or a cool line. The example I go to is Reign of Fire. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So, terrible movie.
But the dragon, the jumping scene? Is that
the jumping, when you're the water tower where McConaughey has his battle axe and he jumps off the top and he gets eaten, which is kind of funny. It kind of reminds me of the scene from that Kong and Skull Island. Do you remember that?
Never saw it.
Okay. So there's a scene where one of the soldiers, he has his two grenades in his hand. Yeah. He's going to sacrifice himself to save everybody from this creature that's going to eat him. Well, the creature doesn't eat him. He hits him with his tail and knocks him away, and he explodes in midair, like really far away. It's intended to be this really dramatic scene, but it's an unintentionally funny.
Oh, well, you will love Deep Blue Sea then when you eventually sit down and watch that. Folks, I did send it home with him.
He did. We'll he was see. A man of we'll his word. That night, he gave it to me before I left, after we were done recording.
So I did not get a chance to watch Far and Away this week, but I will at some point, and I will text you, you know, either laughter or just 1,000 question marks.
Yeah.
First off, just a trivia question. Was this the film that brought Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman together?
No, I think that was Days of Thunder.
Oh, it was. Okay. Yeah. All right.
I'm not...
You're older than me, so you were paying more attention to pop culture back then.
I'll admit my Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman trivia and knowledge is a little rusty. So if there's anybody out there who's like, that's wrong, you're probably right.
Okay. Part of American history that's really not talked about all that much is the treatment of the Irish. Can you tell us a little bit more about how they were treated and why that is so different than what modern historians and what a lot of modern activists think would have been their fate here in this country?
So anytime there's a concentration of people coming into the same ports, there was a bias against them because they believe, okay, you're taking over everything. Mm-hmm. You're trying to buy all the housing. You're trying to get all the jobs. And so that fueled a discrimination against Irish people.
Despite the fact that they and most Americans at the time shared the same skin color.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Yes. And it was substantial to the point where that is why organized crime syndicates arose among the Irish people who were coming in, because there was a belief that, okay, no one's going to help us here, so we're going to help ourselves. We're going to physically take control of certain things. Same thing happened on the Italian side.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, very challenging for people coming over from Ireland to gain any kind of foothold, especially at the ports.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as they dispersed, the biases were carried all over, because as more and more people left the port cities and went out west, they took their prejudices and biases along.
Yeah.
That's a very, very high up view of it. So if you came to these shores broke, which almost everybody did, you needed to find work fast. People knew you needed to find work fast, so they put you to work in places where you were barely paid anything.
Mm-hmm.
Terrible,
demeaning work,
and
paid a couple bucks a week or something like that.
They lived in slums,
mm-hmm.
and there was an attempt to keep those type of people who found themselves in that cycle as broke as possible, so they would have to remain at the ports.
Right.
That fueled a mass migration where some people just left. They didn't even try to save up because they could see the cycle there. And this film does a good job of depicting kind of a snapshot of that.
Yeah. At what period is in American history is this set? Was this part of the kind of the post-Civil War land rush involving the Homestead Act, or was that later on where the government's giving land away, or are they still having to buy this land that they're claiming in Oklahoma?
The film itself was based in the 1890s. It was during the when they were giving away quote-unquote free land.
Okay, so it is part of, either if not the Homestead Act of 1860,
trying to get people 61, out west.
Similar legislation. Yeah, okay, absolutely. So this was the American dream. Have a home. Build your family, make something of yourself.
Right.
Hence the tears.
As many people as we can get out west to settle on the land that is now ours, we're trying to.
They're trying to fill up a continent.
Right.
Okay. And hence the tears at the end there. Just the beauty of the American dream.
Yeah. So the end of Far and Away, and I'm not going to give it away.
Yeah, don't spoil. You've already spoiled one movie here.
It's kind of corny and silly. The very end is...
It's a 90s movie, isn't it?
It is.
It has to be corny and silly.
I feel like it should have ended a couple of times before it actually does. But yeah, the land race, the way it's depicted is just, it blows you away. There are thousands of people involved in this. And they have a slow-mo shot of one guy tries to go first before they fire the cannon for everyone to go, and they shoot him, which is what happened. Yeah.
Wow.
But then they have a slow-mo shot when they fire the cannon, all of the horses like get startled and instantly start to move. And you have this line, this mass of people who are
going. So it was an actual race.
Yeah, yeah. And so they would race to these markers. You were given a flag, and you would get to a marker, and you had to replace the black flag at the green flag. And if it had a green flag, that's your land.
Interesting.
And so... You would, if you got to a marker first before the horde hits, you now grab your gun and you're defending.
You're defending it,
because somebody's going to try and take it. You start shooting people.
Really?
Yeah, and there's one scene during the land race where that actually happens, where you see in the background somebody gets shot. most of the people, it's based on everything I read and the actual, that actual event or those kind of
events.
This
is a real event. I confess, I've never heard of this.
Yeah, it was a real event. Wow. You can see, they did it really well because they show how some people were just on a horse.
Yeah.
Go as fast as you can, find a parcel of land, hold it until your family can show up. Other people packed their whole family in the wagon with all supplies and everything and just barreled, like went out. Wagons were breaking. There was stuff falling out of the wagons. There were people on bikes, you know, the bikes that had the big tire on the front, trying to ride through the wilderness. It was, they were falling off their bikes.
And the government let this happen?
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is like real Hunger Games.
Yeah. Well, it was, it was just like, if you fell off your horse, you were going to get trampled.
I have never heard of this before.
Yeah.
I thought this was like an invented scene within and like the, that's depicting the actual move westward. So this was an actual event, an actual land.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
So
I definitely need to see this movie now.
Did that specific land race happen exactly that way? It's depicting how they
were. But like, it is how they would divvy up the land, basically.
Right. It's like run as, first go as one there. Fast as you can, claim your land, defend it, build, settle.
I'll be darned. Okay. Yeah. Well, all right. I'm putting that on the list.
Yeah. Interesting. And again, it's stories.
Well, yeah. It'll have some corny bits, but at least I want to see that scene. Wow. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Huh. Okay.
Cultural history, John.
Oh, boy.
All right. Your favorite. Let's get to
this movie
Elizabeth,
so
the Golden Age.
Freaking much.
Folks, just behind the scenes, when I was watching John Ida's mic talking about this, the spittle flying from his mouth, I had to put up a shield because he was so
animated. I lapsed into some Shakespearean language, though.
I know you
didn't. Didn't I, Joe?
Yeah. I had to back up the table, or I'd back up from the table a little bit so I wouldn't get pelted. But I could tell you were very fired up.
Not a fan. Not a fan. Which is sad because it's a follow-up to not a perfect, but a good film about Elizabeth. It's just called Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Cate Blanchett, same actress. That film is also not perfect. There are plenty of inaccuracies, but it's way better than this one.
Why did they do this? What can I know? This is speculation.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is so bad. Why did they do this?
There's a part of me. Point? It's funny because that the first one came out in I think it was 1991, 92. So it's like it is at least a decade until you know between the first and the second one, and no one is asking for another Elizabeth. It's like okay, that was good, great. Very few people back when Elizabeth the Golden Age was made were asking for this sequel. There's a part of me that's like, I wonder if this was like some kind of money laundering operation. If there wasn't a lot of stuff changing hands. And that's why the film is so poorly made. It's so poorly shot. It's very clear no one in this film, apart from a couple of the actors, actually cared. There are some actors who do a really good job. Obviously, Cate Blanchett, she's spectacular in pretty much any role. Who's the guy who played Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything? Do you remember his name? He's like, I think he's like 19 or 20 in this film. He plays one of the Babington plot conspirators. He's really good. Jeffrey Rush, another good one. But it seems like a lot of the background characters, and Clive Owen, the guy who plays Sir Walter Raleigh, he's just like reading cue cards. No one really seemed to put any interest in it. The script is awful. No, the script is probably a first draft written by somebody who was high or something like that. First off, it's a precursor to a lot of like modern Hollywood, you know, and their practices. And oh yeah, we'll just make a horrible movie and but we'll put it out there and the shills will love it. And everyone, when that movie came out, New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, all the Hollywood papers were like, oh my gosh, it is absolutely beautiful. It's one of the early examples of what you see now in film, where there is a tremendous difference between the audience reaction and the critics' reaction. Critics like, this is absolutely gorgeous. Oh my gosh, it's such a deep, you know, important examination of the roles of men and women and politics and love in the 17th century or 16th century. And everyone in the audience is like, yes, but the trailer was 90% Spanish and English ships firing at one another. And we got 4 minutes of that. This is awful.
Mm.
So, yeah, not a fan.
Well, it seems like you're pretty definitively hate this film.
I do.
We would strongly encourage all of you in our audience not to watch this.
Unless you like bad movies. And there are some people who are like, I'm going to watch it. And
sometimes they're so bad they're good.
That's true. That's true. Compare it for me, if you will, Dances with Wolves with the best native culture movie that I've seen, which is Last of the Mohicans. Why is Dances with Wolves better?
In terms of historical accuracy, I think they're both kind of questionable, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was talking about it Far and Away, the Move Out West. This shows kind of an example from a military point of view, like in terms of occupying an outpost on the frontier, somebody who is in solitude out there. The film does a good job of showing the wide open spaces.
Mm-hmm.
The entire film is a wide open space. Everything's in the kind of a wide angle. You get just a sense of the emptiness of the prairie and the brutality that comes with man. So and beast. It's not just like animals are nice and helpful. That's not true at all. So in comparison, they're both brutal. The Last of the Mohicans depicts some actual historical events really good way. Apart from being quasi-historical, I think it does a better job at showing those.
Okay. Did Kevin Costner have an English accent in this movie? Is it possible he flipped his accents between this and Robin Hood Men in Tights, Robin Hood Prince of Thieves?
the guy in Men in Tights had an English accent.
Yes, he did.
No, I don't think he's ever had an English accent in anything he's ever.
Okay, he's just done. Maybe not good with accents.
No. In fact, the character Costner's humor in film is really dry.
Yes,
and so it's really dry here too.
Okay, yeah. All right. And then just one more comparison. Sorry, folks, because I haven't seen the film, I can't ask a whole lot of deep questions about this one. Comparing this to Waterworld, another Kevin Costner big budget film from this around the same period.
Yeah,
I actually like Waterworld.
I do too.
I think it's a decent movie.
I'm glad I hadn't heard that. Yeah. I thought I was the only one.
Is it better? Is it worse?
Better.
It is.
It's better. Okay. Yeah. So it's very long.
Well, so is Waterworld. Waterworld is about an hour too long, but.
Two-thirds of Dances with Wolves is really action-packed, and then you get into what happens when the army finally joins him at the outpost.
Mm-hmm.
Not great. And then showing the buffalo hunt, which is pretty amazing.
That was the scene you described. I was like, okay, if for only that scene, kind of like the Oklahoma land race, I would love to see the big shaggies.
As powerful as these animals are, the Native Americans are dropping them with arrows. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. And
does it show them running buffalo off cliffs?
Because
they
don't
did occasionally
so.
Do that. I didn't know if that was part of the film. Okay.
But
did they use every part of the buffalo,
they did.
Joe?
Yeah.
Really? Because in actual history, they did not.
It doesn't show you like them breaking down the bones turning them into like little
knives. Good, because they didn't do that.
Yeah.
But all right.
I love how he narrates the film. And it's just a great story.
He has a good voice. He just can't do accents.
He can't do accents. He should never do any films about mailmen, ever.
I never saw that.
The Postman?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Folks, do not watch The Postman. That's going to be on a future episode of What Not to Watch.
Okay.
All right, John. Religious history.
Yeah.
The Da Vinci Code. So I'm going to go out on a limb and say, not only was this not your favorite movie, you would have rather had a vasectomy than watch it a second time.
I would have rather had two vasectomies.
Okay.
That is correct. I loathe this movie with every fiber in my being. I loathe the book more because the book actually gets more history wrong. They corrupt the theology and the historicity of my savior in both about equally badly. But the book, I mean, Dan Brown, he's either never been to Paris or he doesn't know how to use Google Maps because, and other historians and even just everyday people have confirmed this, like he'll put buildings in Paris in the wrong place, which I understand in film, you have to kind of like contract things. Like in Team America, it seems like every building in Paris is like on one city block or something like that as a parody of how movies work. But you're writing a book, for goodness sake. Just say he went 4 blocks over instead of, or 12 blocks over, something like that. I don't know. As a stickler for detail, not a fan of that. But the bigger problem is his butchering of history rather than geography.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, it's unbelievable. And as I shared briefly during the episode, somebody told me to watch it when the hysteria came out, because from a lot of churches, people were saying this film is exactly how you shared it. And then others were saying, no, you have to approach this with an open mind. Like it's some kind of groundbreaking. No. It's not. It's lazy. It was just thrown together.
And none of it's unique. I mean, these myths about Christ, these myths about the Catholic Church, myths about Mary Magdalene and the Priory of Sion and the Knights Templar and the Holy Grail have been around since at least the 3rd century AD. So like everyone's, oh my gosh, this is so, you know, this is so new. This is so, you know, bold. No. Not really. He's just repackaging old stuff.
So
which is fine if you do it well, and he didn't.
Yeah. So he wasn't even doing sub-creation. He was just grabbing stuff that he had heard of.
No.
So if you were to sum up the film for our audience...
not watch. No, it would be boring characters, bad plot, even worse history.
Okay.
Yeah. As opposed to The Mission, I saw, I think it was in high school, it was a long, long time ago, but very, very good. It's not, from what I remember, not actually depicting one person's life, one historical character's life. It's, again, another kind of amalgamation of several figures. Is that correct?
Yes. It's showing the contrast between somebody who is invading the continent to take slaves and those who were trying to save.
Hollywood really struggles with the whole Age of Discovery with the Earth Columbus basically going forward. Most of their movies about it have been universally bad. Does this film accurately portray, in your opinion, the diversity, not racial diversity, but the diversity of beliefs and of actions of the Europeans?
Totally. 100%.
And does it display the diversity of actions and ideas of the natives?
Yes.
Because some natives were absolutely very welcoming and opening, and sadly the Europeans took advantage of that, and others were like, no, we're gonna fight you, we're gonna kill
100%.
You. 100%.
Okay. Yeah.
And this was set in Venezuela, correct? So not where the Aztecs were or the Incas, the two big empires.
It was set in Argentina.
Oh, it was in Argentina. Okay, yeah. So even further south. Was there any backlash at the time? Because you said who played the main character was Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
Was there any backlash at the time about the character not being portrayed by someone who was ethnically Spanish and therefore a little bit darker and who probably had Hispanic roots?
No, that wasn't as big a concern back then as it is now. They were trying to find a name to attach to the film, and he was a name, and he is a name still.
Yeah.
So in order to get more people into the seats, they wanted somebody famous in the film.
Okay. And was it pretty well received?
Yeah.
Did it change, or did it spark conversations, as far as you know, about kind of looking at, because it was made in the late 90s, correct?
It was in the 80s.
Oh, it was in the 80s. Yeah. Oh, okay. Because that's when the very early turn in historiography. Let's look at the Age of Discovery again. Not uniquely through a racial lens. Let's actually look at individuals. Obviously, films can sometimes push, you know, academic historians in that way. Or was, do you think that was more of a reflection of the fact that, hey, we're starting to do this research. We're starting to look at this period in history differently. Maybe we can make a movie about that.
I'm not totally sure.
That's fine.
I think that some of that was in play. But I think also it's just a good story.
Yeah. You know,
and the goal of getting people into the theater is to portray a good film. It was had some very, very powerful scenes in it.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite scene of it is they're climbing this cliff face, and De Niro's character, Mendoza, he's climbing, and he has this thing weighing him down. It's all of his armor and his sword.
It's almost a Pilgrim's Progress kind
of. Yeah, he's carrying the burden. The ropes are attached on his chest, and he's trying his best to climb up this hill or this mountain face, and he can't do it. So he's going to fall. One of the natives climbs down and he pulls his blade in. He's the one who cuts the burden.
Mm.
That is a very powerful scene.
Mm.
And the burden
image
falls,
of forgiveness.
Falls in the water. Yeah. And so he's not carrying it anymore. He starts to weep on the mountainside.
Wow.
And so then he helps him up. And so towards the end, you have him having to come, like he has to go back for his armor because he chooses a non-passive way to fight off these people who are going to enslave the townspeople that he's befriended. And you see some of the town aligning with him and some aligning with the priest who is saying, we're going to do passive. We're going to conduct a service while they're attacking, and things play out.
Yeah.
So it's a very good movie because it shows the contrast at the time. It shows a redemption, a forgiveness, and the conviction that Mendoza, the character, gained as a result of the forgiveness extended to him is what drives him to save more people.
Mm.
All right, Hunger Games. Just to set the tone, there were a lot of Jennifer Lawrence jokes
there were.
In this particular episode. Why is that, John?
Because recently, Jennifer Lawrence made a statement in an interview where she said that no one had ever cast women as leading roles in action movies until Hunger Games.
Correct. And she did backtrack that a little bit.
She did. And I'm glad she did. I think she probably should have done it a little bit differently because it was not covered nearly as widely. I was watching some media critic who said she should have gone on like SNL and made a joke about it or made fun of herself, because that's one of the most tone deaf things that you could say about Hollywood, because Hollywood has had many great action heroes who were women. Yeah. From Ellen Ripley to Sarah Connor, more recent films. I mean, and even like bad movies, like Species and things
like
that.
It was just weird. It was easily, like you're the culture.
But the context, she was giving an interview to an outlet that was trying to promote having more women in film, which, okay, fine. So she's trying to kind of be a part of that conversation and make some bold claim.
Right.
About it. I'm sure her publicist wrote the line for her. But yes, that's why we put in a couple of jokes about Jennifer Lawrence being the first woman ever.
It was just weird. It's a weird comment.
It was.
You can Google women in film and get a great list. So we made jokes as a result.
Yes,
and
that's all funny and fun. It was all in good fun, J-Law. Right.
So you don't love The Hunger Games because children are being killed. That's very controversial, John.
Well,
I'm just kidding.
No, it's not... Yeah, I don't ever like to see kids get killed. I watch war movies all the time. Yeah. Right. But the fact that it's children hunting and killing each other, I think that's more than anything else. I remember you were actually the one who said when it was first announced, you were like, oh my gosh, this is going to be really great. And I remember thinking, I didn't say anything, but I was just like, really? Kids hunting other kids?
Yeah.
So, and I don't know your thoughts on the books and on the movies, but it has never sat well with me.
And I agree with that. I read the books first, mm-hmm. and the reason why...
Are the books better?
Yeah.
Significantly? Oh, yeah. So they took all the interesting stuff out of the book when they made the movie?
The kids hunting kids shows the brutality of the regime and the reason why the total government control needs to be taken away.
Okay.
So it's this thing that they make parents do as a penance to remind them that they're under the thumb of a federal body.
Mm.
So this governing body. So... That's why I don't like the children killing children. I love that in the story, there's a depiction of rising above that and making sure that that doesn't happen anymore.
I don't know. I was not engaged in the story. It seemed like maybe because I read the first chapter of the book, was like, this is absolutely terrible. Went and saw the movie a couple weeks later, and like the opening scenes were.
I mean,
more
it's not Shakespeare, but
no,
it was just entertaining.
But it was typical teenage drama set in this dystopian world, and I'm just like, okay, well, that's what this is going to be. I've seen all four of the movies. I think it's the third one. The first half of Mockingjay was the best, and it had some objectively, I think, some really really good stuff in it, but a lot of it was just okay. Yeah. More teenage girl drama. Of course, Katniss is the bestest ever.
Yeah. I was taken aback when you said it that way. But yeah.
Shout out to Overlord DVD. So Watchmen, you suggested I watch it, and I did. Back, it was after it was out of the theaters. I didn't see it in theaters, which meant I was denied the ability to see a certain image.
It's pretty graphic.
My goodness.
This was a hard category, as I stated in the podcast, because there are a lot of options. So I was thinking, all right, I need to choose something that is somewhat closely aligned with a timeline that we all experience, the actual timeline. And this is pretty close. There's some obvious deviations, I thought I would not watch this again. So you may be wondering, Joe, why did you put it in the good category? Because of what I just said. The parallel timeline is interesting. The what if is interesting. And that's about it.
And so to start off, kind of a clarification. In the podcast, you said something about the film never makes it clear whether the superheroes, their powers are special, are they actually super? There was like a classification that you put in there. Can you, because I confess, you lost me in that moment. I figured I'll bring it up in the discussion just for anyone who is a little confused like I am.
Some of the characters, like they're shown fighting bad guys or thugs, okay? When they hit... In the film, they're like breaking bones with one punch.
Okay.
So you don't know, like I personally, when I see that, I'm like, okay, well, that's not possible. unless you have some super ability. But that's never said, here's their power. Their power is never defined other than their intention to fight crime and supposedly do the right thing. One of them is the smartest man in the world.
Okay.
So he's super rich and everything else. And so maybe that's his power. Maybe there's somebody smarter who doesn't have his money. You know, it's one of those things where it's
so it's kind of a light touch superpower system that's not really defined in any way.
Yeah, and there are characters like the comedian who, for some reason, is very strong. Again, there's that strength there. Mm-hmm. So you don't know if there's like is he super powered, but he's a combatant. He's also psychotic. He's not really a good guy. Right. So in the process of that, you just question like, what am I seeing here? Am I seeing just the intensity and how they fight or what versus Dr. Manhattan, which is obviously he has godlike powers.
Yes. Yeah. What do you think is the value of watching good speculative or alternate history or is it beyond entertainment? Do you think there is any historical value or any educational value to watching good speculative or alternate history?
That's a great question. I think the value for me is the when I watch how something could have happened, I'm more inclined to reflect on what actually happened.
Mm.
Because now I see another outcome that would probably perceptively have been worse or better. Thinking about it, what would be how would that change the trajectory of history as we know it? And even a small change. So I think that understanding that it's interesting mm-hmm. to think about. So it has that fun aspect to it. Also the reality of it causing further reflection on what actually happened.
Are you familiar with the time travel theory involving Archduke Franz Ferdinand, the guy who was assassinated at the start of the First World War?
Probably. I say probably because I've read a lot of those. So what
okay, because until actually this morning, I was tutoring a student. He brought it up probably as a way to deflect from our lesson. Good job, Eli. Because it worked. I think he said he got it off of Reddit. People were talking about the idea because there were two assassination attempts on the same day. The first one was an agent of the Black Hand, the Serbian terrorist group, threw a bomb at the Archduke's car. And the account's different, either it missed or the Archduke kind of like swatted it out of the air or one of the bodyguards stopped it. And the theory is the first time traveler caused that bomb to miss. Because he wanted to save the Archduke. And then the theory is the second time traveler was Gavrilo Princip, the man who shot him. That something happened that in that moment when the Archduke lived, it changes all of human history and people, and this new timeline was created, and it's absolutely terrible. It's horrifying. And so another time traveler goes back and says, yeah, for the good of humanity, this guy has to die.
No, I haven't heard
that. You've not heard that? I just thought that was an interesting kind of speculative.
Wow.
History there. I'm like, there's probably a story in there.
That's really
somewhere.
No, I have not heard that. That's very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
We don't normally do what if stuff, but I asked you the question.
We did a whole summer of it.
Well, that's true. Yeah. We don't like what if history.
Well, I do. You do not.
Yes. No shoes are being thrown today. All right, last category.
All right. So I've since the podcast aired, I have admittedly gone back to think about the epic scene you described of the stove/oven.
Yes.
The parrot and quoting scripture.
And it was a gas stove, Joe.
Gas stove.
Yeah.
Can we all agree?
Does that concern you?
No, and it should concern no one. A gas stove should not concern single soul.
But Joe, several city leaders have told us.
Yeah. Do not pay attention to them. Enjoy your gas stove. It's clean energy. So Deep Blue Sea, you did a great job of explaining why you picked it, and we got a comment from our audience who's talking about how it was, in fact, a wonderful event in the Streeter household. Your mom commented and said, actually, I remember that, and it was awesome.
Yes.
Right? Yeah.
She said she encouraged me to throw the rolled-up sock at my sister.
Awesome. That is awesome. And so thinking about this film, like, why is it stuck with you, I guess, is my only question. Like, obviously, you enjoyed it. It has a lot of memories.
No, it really is. It's the family connections. First time I saw it was in the theater with my dad. Scared me to death. My dad took me to see Jaws at a very young age, way too young. I was like 5. And he enjoyed scaring the you-know-what out of me so much that the movie came out in 97, so I was 13, 14, thereabouts. I think I'm getting the date right. If not, go back and re-listen to the episode and send us a message correcting me. And so when I was a teenager, my dad took me to see this, and I remember it also, it scared me, but it's that memory of going to see movies with my dad that was one of the things that we did together. And then the moment of seeing, of scaring my sister. And then the third one is that those funny scenes in the film of you know, LL Cool J, he's quoting scripture like a Baptist preacher, and then he kills a shark by cooking it in the oven. And Samuel L. Jackson's death scene, you will text me like, yep, that was the greatest scene in the movie by far. Possibly nice. Samuel L. Jackson's greatest film scene outside of Pulp Fiction.
He's had a lot of great film scenes, so that's a bold statement.
It is. Oh, it is.
Nice.
English Patient, another one I haven't seen, and after hearing this, I have no plans to see it.
Yeah, so...
You envied a guy who... was euthanized or something like that.
So I love.
What is this movie about?
So I love the. It's about a pilot who is injured, and he's an English patient.
Yeah. Okay. You know,
and anyway, he gets involved at the nurse who's married. He's married. Anyway, I never understood as I got older when it came out. I was not allowed to see it, but when it later on when I saw it, I was like, oh yeah, everybody, this is critically acclaimed. This has won Oscars. I'm gonna watch this. And the whole thing, I felt like I was on crazy pills. Like, I don't care. I don't care. And I enjoyed the backdrop. I kept wanting to see some more of that. The music is great. The pace. It's just not a story I like.
All right. So, Joe, I have a pop quiz for you. I'm going to add a new category. This is not a history category, but I want your take on this. Is your favorite, not best or not the worst. This is your favorite. Your favorite hand-drawn, not computer animated, hand-drawn cartoon or animated film, and why?
Sword in the Stone.
Really? Why?
I it's a great story. It's fun. It's funny. As a kid, I thought there were certain scenes when he would change into an animal or a fish. You know, as a kid, you would always want to do that. Or I did anyway. Yeah, I mean, it'd be cool. You're like, I wonder what it's like to be a fish in the water. And you see the character do that. Plus, they have a wizard's duel, which is really fun. So, yeah, that would be top of the list.
Okay.
So, since you sprang that on me, John, I'm going to put you on the spot with a category that will make you uncomfortable. What is your favorite romance movie of all time?
Oh, hands down, Lord of the Rings.
That's a romance film?
Well, I mean, okay, how do we define romance
film? I see it as one.
I mean, if we're talking about a film that has romance in it, it's either Lord of the Rings or the original Star Wars.
Couple-centered, a relationship-centered.
Okay, so where a relationship is the central focus. Okay. My mother would be very happy if I said it was While You Were Sleeping, because that is her favorite. But I'm going to go with, can I say The Terminator? Because that's a story about a relationship between a man and a woman.
Touche. I don't have a pushback on that.
Alien?
No, it's not.
I mean, it is a relationship, but it's between...
No, it's not Alien.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Terminator.
Okay.
Yeah.
Touche.
I was trying
to corner you there.
I know.
You broke out of it.
Or, no, actually, okay, well, Casablanca.
Oh,
there
yes.
we go.
Excellent.
Yes, I just thought of that one. Yep, I absolutely love Casablanca.
Yeah, I do too. Fantastic choice.
Yeah.
John and I really love doing these types of episodes because not only, as we said in the podcast, history is depicted sometimes very well in films and they bring a level of experience not present in a book. But as we go through these, and we will have some more of these in the future, it's always our goal to highlight the fun in film, to have fun in these conversations. But also, we hope that when you go to watch a historical film, you don't just stop there. Go and confirm that the information you just saw is correct, because you don't want to be left with information that would be incorrect.
Yeah.
Again, there's a difference between correct and right. We want to be correct here. That's, I think, one of our biggest takeaways every time we talk about history and film.
Agreed. We also really love hearing from you, our wonderful audience. Speaking as a history teacher, it's fun. It really is, talking to Joe and to get the occasional message from you guys. But as a teacher, I love to have that interaction with you guys. We would love to get more questions, even if it's just something simple. Teachers out there who are listening know that it's great if your audience can give us a little bit of feedback. So a shameless plea, basically, from all of you. We would love to get, as we start the second half of this season, we would love to get more questions, your comments, your thoughts. We don't necessarily have to read them on the podcast or anything like that. We just want to interact with you guys, our audience. We are so thankful that you guys are out there, that you're listening. We see in our metrics the audience growing. We would love to continue to get to know you guys, to have conversations with you. So as we start the second half of the season, we would love to hear from each and every one of you.
Absolutely. And the way that you can do that is you can do that on Instagram or Facebook. That is an option.
Comment also, on Spotify, correct?
Yes.
Is that available?
Every episode on Spotify, we have a question on that platform where you can go and submit answers or your own question as well. On top of that, on our website, when you go to 15minutehistorypodcast.org, there's a subscribe and support button that takes you to a page where you scroll. You can find the contact us form there. And right beside the contact us form is our email address, 15minutehistory@gmail.com. To John's point, our audience is expanding. And as more and more of you join our episodes each week and our discussions, that gives you the opportunity and gives us the opportunity to interact more as well. Thank you for joining us in our discussion of What to Watch, History and Movies, Part 3. I'm Joe Parker.
And I'm John Streeter.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. As our audience continues to grow, we want to expand this podcast. And you can join us by going to 15minutehistorypodcast.org, clicking on the support and subscribe button, and donating now. Thank you, and see you all next week.